Hi folks, I am Alan Watt and this is Cutting Through the Matrix. Carl Gustav Jung came on the scene at the same time as Freud, when this really relatively early exoteric form of psychiatry and psychology were announced to the world. And Carl Gustav Jung differed with Freud in many, many aspects. Freud's job was basically to attempt to have us individually give up any thought that human life, in a sense, was sacred. We were just a form of animal, higher animal, which can be reshaped. We're just conditioned reflexes and responses and all that kind of stuff, to things that happened in our childhood and our family arrangement. We adopted all the good parts and all the bad parts. We copied behavior. We were products of our environment. And there was nothing more to it. And therefore, if you were not sacred in a sense, you were like plastic or plasticine. You were just a building material where professionals like Freud himself could come in and experiment on you to alter you into something which he would want to create more perfect in his eyes. I'm going to read a little bit from Jung, who opposed, because of his own experiences, he opposed the completely atheistic, mundane view of Freud. He knew there was more to the human psyche than just conditioned responses and a bunch of neurons in the brain. That doesn't make you you. And no matter how many degrees you string together in pseudosciences and various pseudosciences all combining together in behaviorism and various forms of psychology and study, doesn't alter reality. Although they'd like to, they certainly would like to. It might sound very impressive, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's true. You'll always find that down through history, you find dominant groups rising and falling as new ones come up. And their first thing to do is to take over the power over the people, because the only ones who produce anything to keep everyone in at the top in comfort are the masses at the bottom. That's just the history of the world. It's a form of slavery, pure and simple. You can keep changing the terms and call societies by different names, but if it looks like a duck and walks like a duck, then it's quacks like a duck, it's a duck, you see. So this little bit is from Carl Jung, talking about religion as the counterbalance to mass-mindedness. When he wrote this, the Cold War was supposedly on, and the Soviet system, and he wasn't in on the big overall plan, I know that, and to him the Cold War was very real. However, he did describe the Soviet system very well. Now, we know the Soviet system is now combined with the capitalist system to make the third way, where they combine the bureaucracies of the Soviet-style government, and we have the fascism of an ultra-dominant elite, very rich at the top. And it's to get much, much worse. It's getting worse all the time, let's be honest. This is what he says about religion as a counterbalance to mass-mindedness. In order to free the fiction of the sovereign state, in other words, the whims of those who manipulate it, from every wholesome restriction, all socio-political movements tending in this direction invariably try to cut the ground from under the religions. for in order to turn the individual into a function of the state. His dependence on anything beside the state must be taken from him. But religion means dependence on and submission to the irrational facts of experience. These do not refer directly to social and physical conditions. They concern far more the individual's psychic attitude. By psychic, he's talking about the wholesome, the complete you, the total you, your mind, personality, everything. But it is possible to have an attitude to the external conditions of life only when there is a point of reference outside them. The religions give or claim to give such a standpoint, thereby enabling the individual to exercise his judgment and his power of decision. They build up reserve, as it were, against the obvious and inevitable force of circumstances to which everyone is exposed who lives only in the outer world and has no other ground under his feet except the pavement. If statistical reality is the only reality, then it is the sole authority. Now that's a very important statement that's been echoed by others since. If statistical reality is the only reality, then it is the sole authority. Statistics in the game of statistics is a trick learned from religion, only upgraded to a better version. We can say, well, there's lies, then there's damn lies, meaning more intricate lies, and then there are statistics. Well, statistics pretend to hide behind the guise of science. And we're trained and conditioned that science is the new priesthood, and whatever they say must be true. And they use statistics to convince us. The longer you live, the more you will see little bits coming out in newspapers and over media where scientific institutions come up with new theories all the time, often contradicting the last theory that was held as the gospel truth for the last 10, 20 years. And they never notice, they never mention or make a big deal that, well, we're taking the opposite view now, and this is now the gospel truth. And they always use statistics to verify every version they give you. So statistics are very useful in conditioning people, especially the mass man, who doesn't want to stand out like a sore thumb from everyone else. There is then only one condition, and since no contrary condition exists, judgment and decision are not only superfluous but impossible. Then the individual is bound to be a function of statistics, and hence a function of the state, or whatever the abstract principle of order may be called. Abstract principle of order. The religions, however, teach another authority opposed to that of the world. The doctrine of the individual's dependence on God makes just as high a claim upon him as the world does. It may even happen that the absoluteness of this claim estranges him from the world in the same way he is estranged from himself when he succumbs to the collective mentality. He can forfeit his judgment and power of decision in the former case, for the sake of religious doctrine, quite as much as in the latter. This is the goal the religions openly aspire to unless they compromise with the state. When they do, I prefer to call them not religions, but creeds. Very important part, this. A creed gives expression to a definite collective belief, whereas the word religion expresses a subjective relationship to certain metaphysical, extra-mundane factors. A creed is a confession of faith intended chiefly for the world at large, and is thus an intra-mundane affair. While the meaning and purpose of a religion lie in the relationship of the individual to God, that's in the Western Hemisphere, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, or to the path of salvation and liberation, such as within Buddhism. From this basic fact, all ethics is derived, which, without the individual's responsibility before God, can be called nothing more than conventional morality. So a creed is something you're born into. It's an accepted form of collective rituals that have built up over a long, long period of time. It becomes custom, tradition, mainly tradition, and the initial fire that was instilled is doused, it's gone under ritualism, custom, social doctrine, which comes into it. The liberating factor is gone, and those people conform to the state system because their churches are registered and authorized by the state. They also have a lot of rules to follow. They can't talk about certain subjects, and that's given to them, a list that's given to them by the state if they are tax exempt. Nothing is free in this world, nothing in this system. From this fact, this basic fact, all ethics is derived, which without the individual's responsibility before God can be called nothing more than conventional morality. See, that's what the creeds end up doing. You have conventional morality, custom, etc. Since they are compromises with mundane reality, the creeds have accordingly seen themselves obliged to undertake a progressive codification of their views, doctrines, and customs, and in so doing have externalized themselves to such an extent that the authentic religious element in them, the living relationship to and direct confrontation with their extra-mundane point of reference, has been thrust into the background. The denominational standpoint measures the worth and importance of the subjective religious relationship by the yardstick of traditional doctrine. And where this is not so frequent as in Protestantism, one immediately hears talk of pietism, sectarianism, eccentricity, and so forth, as soon as anyone claims to be guided by God's will. A creed coincides with the established church, or at any rate forms of a public institution whose members include not only true believers but vast numbers of people who can only be described as indifferent in matters of religion and who belong to it simply by force of habit. Here the difference between a creed and a religion becomes palpable. To be the adherent of a creed, therefore, is not always a religious matter, but more often a social one, and as such, it does nothing to give the individual any foundation. For support, he has to depend exclusively on his relation to an authority which is not of this world. The criterion here is not lip service to a creed, but the psychological fact that the life of the individual is not determined solely by the ego and its opinions or by social factors, but quite as much, if not more, by a transcendent authority. It is not ethical principles, however lofty, or creeds, however orthodox, that lay the foundations for the freedom and autonomy of the individual, but simply and solely the empirical awareness, the incontrovertible or convertible experience of an intensely personal reciprocal relationship between man and an extra-mundane authority which acts as a counterpoise to the world and its reason. This formulation will not please either the mass man or the collective believer. For the former, the policy of the state is a supreme principle of thought and action. Indeed, this was the purpose for which he was enlightened, and accordingly the mass man grants the individual a right to exist only in so far as the individual is a function of the state. The believer, on the other hand, while admitting that the state has a moral and factual claim, confesses to the belief that not only man but the state that rules him is subject to the overlordship of God, and in that, in case of doubt, the supreme decision will be made by God and not by the state. Since I do not presume to any metaphysical judgments, I must leave it open, an open question, where the word, that is, the phenomenal world of man, and hence nature in general, is the opposite of God or not. I can only point to the fact that the psychological opposition between these two realms of experience is not only vouched for in the New Testament, but is still exemplified very plainly today in the negative attitude of the dictator states to religion, and of the church to atheism and materialism. He's showing you the dialectic between science, which is the new religion, and like all religions, to be supreme, they must be absolute, and they demand absolute obedience. We see that with inoculations trying to get forced through from what were recently, and some are still called, as health services. Well, since when does a service dictate to you? And I'll tell you when it dictates to you, is when it's had a period where we have never stopped and told them to get off our backs. Because the longer we allow things, the more dictatorial they become. That's the nature of the bully. And there is no satisfying the bully. No matter how much you grovel, there is no satisfying them. They demand more and more. That's what power is all about. Just as man as a social being cannot in the long run exist without a tie to the community. Now that doesn't speak for everyone. So the individual never find the real justification for his existence, and his own spiritual and moral autonomy anywhere except in the extra-mundane principle capable of relativizing the overpowering influence of external factors. The individual who is not anchored in, say, God, can offer no resistance on his own resources to the physical and moral blandishments of the world. For this he needs the evidence of inner, transcendent experience, which alone can protect him from the otherwise inevitable submersion in the mass. Merely intellectual or even moral insight into the stultification and moral irresponsibility of the mass man is a negative recognition only, and amounts to not much more than a wavering on the road to the atomization of the individual. It lacks the driving force of religious conviction, since it is merely rational. The dictator state has one great advantage over bourgeois reason. Now, bourgeois is the old term for middle class that they used to use in the communist sector. So this is the great advantage it has over the middle class reason. Along with the individual, it swallows up his religious forces. The state has taken the place of God. That is why, seen from this angle, the socialist dictatorships are religions, and state slavery is a form of worship. But the religious function cannot be dislocated and falsified in this way without giving rise to secret doubts, which are immediately repressed so as to avoid conflict with the prevailing trend towards mass-mindedness. That's what we see in George Orwell's 1984. We see the conflicts that Winston goes through and that they all go through. It's almost been like in a computer program where you're always being updated with new data, and you're supposed to just go along with it and change direction at the whim of the state. The result, as always in such cases, is overcompensation in the form of fanaticism, which in its turn is used as a weapon for stamping out the least flicker of opposition. He's talking here about when the state becomes God. Now remember, in the completely mundane, the worldly, the scientific system, which has its own religion, it's a religion, it's on evolution and all this kind of stuff that's never been proven either. You take an awful lot of faith to believe in evolution. He's telling you that if you believe in nothing more than a collection of cells with conditioned responses that can be altered through behavioral psychology and repetition and all of that, then the state can do with you as they see fit, because if they claim you're abnormal, they then have the right to normalize you according to the dictates of the state. And like all gods, you see, the state, when it becomes God, can have no other gods before it. So they will not stand for any other point of view or rationale as to who you are and what your duties to the state are. It will not stand for any opposition. In fact, it's worse than religion. Religion, for all of its horrors, and they had plenty, built into it, at least showed you the hypocrisy, because they didn't even follow their own dictates of the books that they supposedly followed. There was no compassion in the horror shows that they brought on. But at least the writings were still contained for the few to say, wait a minute here, why are they going around burning and slaughtering people? Whereas with the state, there will be no literature given out to oppose what they're doing. Man.
Greetings.
Free opinion in the mass state is stifled and moral decision ruthlessly suppressed on the plea that the end justifies the means, even the vilest. The policy of the state is exalted to a creed. The leader or party boss becomes a demigod beyond good and evil, and his votaries are honored as heroes, martyrs, apostles, missionaries. There is only one truth, and beside it no other. It is sacrosanct and above criticism. Anyone who thinks differently is a heretic who, as we know from history, is threatened with all manner of unpleasant things. Only the party boss, who holds the political power in his hands, can interpret the state doctrine authentically, and he does so just as suits him. This should be ringing little alarm bells in people's minds when they see what we're going through today and they remember the laws and so on that have been imposed, all very ominous to something to come. When, through mass rule, the individual becomes social unit number so-and-so. Now remember that. When, through mass rule, the individual becomes social unit number so-and-so, whatever your number is that you've been given, and the state is elevated to the supreme principle, it is only to be expected that the religious function, too, will be sucked into the maelstrom. Religion, as the careful observation and taking account of certain invisible and uncontrollable factors, is an instinctive attitude peculiar to man, and its manifestations can be followed all through human history. Its evident purpose is to maintain the psychic balance, for the natural man has an equally natural knowledge of the fact that his conscious functions may at any time be thwarted by uncontrollable happenings coming from inside as well as from outside. For this reason, he is always taking care that any difficult decision likely to have consequences for himself and others shall be rendered safe by suitable measures of a religious nature. Offerings are made to the invisible powers, formidable blessings are pronounced, and all kinds of solemn rites are performed. Everywhere and at all times there have been rites d'entrée et de sortie, whose magical efficacy is denied and which are impugned as magic and superstition by rationalists incapable of psychological insight. But magic has above all a psychological effect whose importance should not be underestimated. The performance of a magical action, that's in quotation marks, gives the person concerned a feeling of security, which is absolutely essential for carrying out a decision, because a decision is inevitably somewhat one-sided and is therefore rightly felt to be a risk. Even a dictator thinks it necessary not only to accompany his acts of state with threats, but to stage them with all manner of solemnities, brass bands, flags, banners, parades, and monster demonstrations are no different in principle from the ecclesiastical processions, cannonades, and fireworks to scare off demons. Only the suggestive parade of state power engenders a collective feeling of security, which, unlike religious demonstrations, gives the individual no protection against his inner demonism. Hence he will cling all the more to the power of the state, that is, to the mass, thus delivering himself up to it psychically as well as morally, and putting the finishing touch to his social depotentiation. The state, like the church, demands enthusiasm, self-sacrifice, and love. And if religion requires or presupposes the fear of God, then the dictator state takes good care to provide the necessary terror. When the rationalist directs the main force of his attack against the magical effect of the rite, as asserted by tradition, he has in reality completely missed the mark. The essential point, the psychological effect, is overlooked, although both parties make use of it for directly opposite purposes. A similar situation prevails with regard to their respective conceptions of the goal. The goals of religion, such as deliverance from evil, reconciliation with God, rewards in the hereafter, and so on, turn into worldly promises about freedom from care for one's daily bread, the just distribution of material goods, universal prosperity in the future, and a shorter working hour or week. That the fulfillment of these promises is as far off as paradise only furnishes yet another analogy and underlines the fact that the masses have been converted from an extra-mundane goal to a purely worldly belief, which is extolled with exactly the same religious fervor and exclusiveness that the creeds display in the other direction. In order not to repeat myself unnecessarily, I shall not enumerate all the parallels between worldly and otherworldly beliefs, but shall content myself with emphasizing the fact that a natural function, which has existed from the beginning, like the religious function, cannot be disposed of with rationalistic and so-called enlightened Christianism. You can, of course, represent the doctrinal contents of the creeds as impossible, and subject them to ridicule, but such methods miss the point, and do not hit the religious function which forms the basis of the creeds. Religion, in the sense of conscientious regard for the rational factors of the psyche and individual fate, reappears, evilly distorted, in the deification of the state and the dictator. Naturum expellas furca tamen, usque recurrit. You can throw out nature with a pitchfork, but she'll always turn up again. The leaders and dictators, having weighed up the situation correctly, are therefore doing their best to gloss over the all too obvious parallel with the deification of Caesar, and to hide the real power behind the fiction of the state. Though this is, this of course alters nothing. As I have already pointed out, the dictator state, besides robbing the individual of his rights, has also cut the ground from under his feet psychically by depriving him of metaphysical foundations of his existence. The ethical decision of the individual human being no longer counts. What alone matters is the blind movement of the masses, and the lie has thus become the operative principle of political action. The state has drawn the logical conclusions from this, as the existence of many millions of state slaves completely deprived of all rights mutually testifies. He was talking then about the communist system. We saw that in China too. So he's saying that you can try and crush out obeyance to one master, but it must transform and simply obey the new master in a similar way, with a similar fanaticism if need be. That's why horror intensifies as it ping-pongs between one form and the other, from religion, which is the worship of whatever deity they've given you, to the state itself, when you worship the state. The only difference being, with religion, in most religions you'll find there's some kind of empathy for victims once in a while, mixed with all the hatred for those who oppose them, and that's true too. But there's always some kind of mercy here and there with the state, which is law. There's none. Both the dictator state and denominational religion lay quite particular emphasis on the idea of community. Now this is very important, because now we see it's come together. We've seen that capitalism and communism had the same goals all along, because they were invented by the same people as the dialectic. Both the dictator state and denominational religion lay quite particular emphasis on the idea of community. This is the basic ideal of communism, and it is thrust down the throats of the people so much that it has the exact opposite of the desired effect. It inspires divisive mistrust. The church, which is no less emphasized, appears on the other side as a communal ideal. It's an ideal, not a reality. And where the church is notoriously weak, as in Protestantism, the hope of or belief in a communal experience makes up for the painful lack of cohesion. And that's what the Protestants think too, it's a mass rising from the grave and up they go and they're all saved and that's it. And Billy Graham's in the vanguard leading the charge with a big flag. The hope of or belief in a communal experience makes up for the painful lack of cohesion. As can easily be seen, community, inverted commas, is an indispensable aid in the organization of masses and is therefore a two-edged weapon. Just as the addition of however many zeros will never make a unit, so the value of a community depends on the spiritual and moral stature of the individuals composing it. For this reason, one cannot expect from the community any effect that would outweigh the suggestive influence of the environment. That is, a real and fundamental change in individuals, whether for good or for bad. Such changes can only come from the personal encounter between man and man, but not from communistic or Christian baptisms en masse, which do not touch the inner man. How superficial the effect of communal propaganda actually is can be seen from recent events in Europe. That was a while ago. the communal ideal reckons without its host, overlooking the individual human being who in the end will assert his claims. Now, the elite know that the individual would have to assert his claims, and that's the rush-on for the totalitarian system we're now into, where everyone's watched and monitored and ultimately will get all chipped. They know this. They know what Young's talking about because they have all these professionals and large boards and committees employed full-time working on this kind of strategy. They understand that you cannot suppress the individual past a certain point. Then he must reassert himself, its nature. But they know this. Psychological warfare, well understood in higher military quarters and specialized departments. But the breaking off the individual from the individual was always the goal of totalitarian governments and systems. The real system is above the government. The government's only part of the system. It is interesting that really there's nothing new under the sun when it comes to explaining philosophies or, in some cases, new sciences, as they're sometimes called, such as psychiatry or psychology. I've read a piece before from Carl Gustav Jung's book called The Undiscovered Self. He talks about the shadow side of people. The shadow side is the deep unconscious sea which participates in decision making, because it's through your emotions that it can get its own way over an intellect or rationality at times. As I say, it's always easier to do the wrong thing than the right thing. But he's talking in this book about some of the things he saw coming back in the 40s and 50s. The old argument was, oh, who is more powerful, an individual or the group? Well, we know that everything that has some kind of power today in the authorized structure are authorized groups affiliated as members with United Nations. Carl Jung, on page 102, talks about the individual man. He says, the individual man knows that as an individual being he is more or less meaningless and feels himself the victim of uncontrollable forces. But, on the other hand, he harbors within himself a dangerous shadow and opponent who is involved as an invisible helper in the dark machinations of the political monster. It is in the nature of political bodies always to see the evil in the opposite group. Same with people, of course, and tribes. Just as the individual has an ineradicable tendency to get rid of everything he does not know and does not want to know. And that's more important, that last part. He doesn't want to know about himself by foisting it off on somebody else. In other words, take out the big spike in your own eye before you criticize others, or people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. It's been said over and over and over again, much more simply. Nothing has a more divisive and alienating effect upon society than this moral complacency and lack of responsibility, and nothing promotes understanding and rapprochement more than the mutual withdrawal of projections we project onto others, that which we don't want to see or admit to within ourselves. This necessarily corrective requires self-criticism, for one cannot just tell the other person to withdraw them. He does not recognize them for what they are,
any more than one does oneself. We can recognize our prejudices and delusions only when, from a broader psychological knowledge of ourselves and others, we are prepared to doubt the absolute rightness of our assumptions and compare them carefully and conscientiously with the objective facts. We see this with the politicians, with their goals, and the band leaders, you know, Bush and Blair, etc., as they demonize the enemy, the standard strategy to get the public whipped up behind them. They always demonize and dehumanize the enemy, while they themselves have done far more worse at home. Far more worse, actually, when they're in the know of what's been happening with their own populations over a long period of time, with inoculations, autism, and debilitating diseases, often which come out of laboratories. But no, they can always point over the sea somewhere at someone who's different, dresses differently, talks a different language, has different customs, and that's them projecting their own hatred outside of themselves onto others. We can recognize our prejudices and illusions only when, from a broader psychological knowledge of ourselves and others, we are prepared to doubt the absolute rightness of our assumptions and compare them carefully and conscientiously with objective facts. Funnily enough, self-criticism is an idea much in vogue in Marxist countries, but there it is subordinated to ideological considerations and must serve the state, and not truth and justice in men's dealings with one another. The mass state has no intention of promoting mutual understanding and the relationship of man to man. It strives rather from atomization for the psychic isolation of the individual. The more unrelated individuals are, that's like to each other, the more consolidated the state becomes, and vice versa. Now I'll read that last part again because it's very, very pertinent to this topic I'm on about today. The mass state, and that's what we're in today, the collective, they chose the collective society long ago at the Royal Institute of International Affairs and the Club of Rome as being the ideal state for managing the populace by a bureaucracy. While above them, of course, as I've said before, are the fascist ones, the ones who interbreed, believe in eugenics, believe they are superior. But yeah, all those below are really run by a communistic system of sameness. Everyone must be the same, have same opinions, be politically correct. The mass state has no intention of promoting mutual understanding and the relationship of man to man. It strives rather for atomization, for the psychic isolation of the individual. The more unrelated individuals are, the more consolidated the state becomes, and vice versa. Then he goes on to say, there can be no doubt that in democracies too, the distance between man and man is much greater than is conducive to public welfare or beneficial to our psychic needs. True, all sorts of attempts are being made to level out glaring social contrasts by appealing to people's idealism, enthusiasm, and ethical conscience. But characteristically, one forgets to apply the necessary self-criticism to answer the question, who is making the idealistic demand? Is it perchance someone who jumps over his own shadow, his own unconscious, in order to hurl himself avidly on an idealistic program that promises him a welcome alibi? An alibi for his real intent. And that, of course, is what the psychopath does. The psychopath smells the crowd, what they want to hear, and becomes the champion. It's been used over and over. Once he has authority over the people, he was off in tangents the public never suspected. That is part of the problem today. The public have been trained, and they also have tribal instincts, regardless of the era we live in. We have natural tribal instincts where we want to deify almost leaders. At one time, the leaders lived like the people. They had no more possessions than the people, but through the introduction of money, which gave them power and more material wealth, and then standing armies, they placed themselves perpetually and their offspring in power. On page 105 of The Undiscovered Self, Jung says this: reflections of this kind should not be taken as superfluous sentimentalities. The question of human relationship and of the inner cohesion of our society is an urgent one in view of the atomization of the pent-up mass man, whose personal relationships are undermined by general mistrust. Wherever justice is uncertain, now listen to this, wherever justice is uncertain and police spying and terror are at work, human beings fall into isolation, which of course is the aim and purpose of the dictator state, since it is based on the greatest possible accumulation of depotentiated social units. To counter this danger, the free society needs a bond of an effective, emotional, that is, effective nature, a principle of a kind like caritas, the Christian love of your neighbour. But it is justice love for one's fellow man that suffers most of all from the lack of understanding wrought by projection. This last part is so important. Wherever justice is uncertain and police spying and terror are at work. You see, the war on terror is a war of terror, well understood in revolutionary circles for a long, long time, hundreds and hundreds of years. The doublespeak of the psychopath is to project it and distort it till you think it's out there somewhere and you're having a war against it. But in fact, the dictator state, with its spying on every individual, its total information network, as it's called now, with the occasional show on television as they take down families or individuals who don't quietly comply or are suspect in some way or other, the exact same techniques used in the Soviet system. Which shouldn't surprise us, since they have people who work for the KGB working now for the Pentagon and for the White House. The same techniques are in use as they rush forward the next part of this plan, this revolutionary plan of total domination. Wherever justice is uncertain and police spying and terror are at work, is to terrorize the public who view this. Human beings fall into isolation. They don't communicate with each other except on a very superficial, automatic level, such as have a nice day. How are we today? The weather is nice. The weather could be better. How about them Jays, eh? Or whatever other sports team is in vogue right now. That is all they can say to each other without worrying about saying the wrong thing and being reported. As he says here, the ideal, which never happened, of course, because ideals seldom do, but the ideal Christian love of your neighbor, a form of caritas, should overcome this, but it suffers because we project onto everyone else who's different all of her own fears. When people are being heavily criticized as a group, such as people coming in from other countries, it's because the person who sees them coming in is fearful of them, fearful of losing what he thinks or she thinks is his or her culture being invaded. So things are projected onto them. Their own fears are turned around. You project your fears onto those who come in. And yes, there's no doubt about it, when it comes in en masse, as all governments at the top know, you do have culture clashes for a while, because there are great differences within customs and ways of living. This is also being used to tighten up control over all peoples, including the newcomers, because to those at the top, the white peasant, the yellow peasant, the brown peasant, the black peasant is still one big group of what they call junk genes. Otherwise, you'd be up there with the elite. They think all evolution has been at a stasis for too long, and all those very wealthy, rich families who've held on to power and wealth down through generations have proven their superiority. They've proven the superior genes that they have, you see. For the rest of you commoners, well, you're junk genes, and therefore you're fair game to be exploited. The natural way of the predator, you might say. That's how a predator and a psychopath views the people. The antidote to this, as Jung said, is to extend and put down your shield for a little while and test the waters to see how that works, because the people must come together. They must come together, or they're doomed. They're all doomed together if they don't. The global elite have no favorite peoples, no matter what some think.
Carl Jung, in his books, has been a good source of information on the psychology, not only of the ones at the top, but the masses who follow. He tends to show you how the mass man thinks, and that the war, down through the ages, isn't simply about a dominant elite or a dominant minority, who certainly do know how to manipulate the masses by altering your perceptions. They understand your computer brain language, you might say, and they bring you to what you think are your conclusions. But he also goes into the followers, the sheep, the big herds of sheep. And the shepherds and the sheep couldn't really do without each other. That's the problem. The masses don't like anything that really is different from themselves. That's been standard down through history as well. They like you to conform. Every big group wants you to conform to their particular system. And in the Undiscovered Self by Jung, on page 58, he talks a little bit about this problem. He's talking about the battle between the individual and the mass organizations. He said, it is time we asked ourselves exactly what we are lumping together in mass organizations and what constitutes the nature of the individual human being, that is, of the real man and not the statistical man. This is hardly possible except through a new process of self-nourishment. All mass movements, as one might expect, slip with the greatest ease down an inclined plane represented by large numbers. Where the many are, there is security. What the many believe must, of course, be true. But what the many want must be worth striving for, and necessary, and therefore good. In the clamor of the many, there lies the power to snatch wish fulfillment by force. Sweetest of all, however, is that gentle and painless slipping back into the kingdom of childhood, into the paradise of parental care, into happy-go-luckiness and irresponsibility. All the thinking and looking after are done from the top. To all questions there is an answer, and for all needs the necessary provision is made. The infantile dream state of the mass man is so unrealistic that he never thinks to ask who is paying for this paradise. The balancing of accounts is left to a higher political or social authority, which welcomes the task, for its power is thereby increased, and the more power it has, the weaker and more helpless the individual becomes. Wherever social conditions of this type develop on a large scale, the road to tyranny lies open, and the freedom of the individual turns into spiritual and physical slavery. So that's basically it summed up right there. The masses have been trained too, mind you, by other people who run institutions who understand what Jung is talking about here, because they understand the psychiatry or the psychology or the psychodynamics of people, because they've been studying people down through many, many, many centuries. And they know how to exploit us all. And they know our weaknesses, our Achilles heel. And they exploit it. Find the weakness, exploit it. And that's already happened. Socialism, you see, which really is what this is all about, this democracy. The socialism, it doesn't matter if you call it democracy or fascism, it's all the same movement towards the same goal. Control over the mass man. But socialism is perpetual childhood.
From myself, Alan Watt, it's good night to me, your God or your gods go with you.